Chapter 31. Big Business. By the fall of 1914, American big business had a clear perception that the European war, horrible as it was, could translate into windfall profits. Wilson's peace efforts had weakened the impact of the charge of war profiteering, and business felt justified to seize the opportunity of the century. Within a few years, the United States, with only 4.5 million industrial workers at the beginning of 1900, would become not only the granary of the world but an industrial giant. The warring nations needed American raw materials. Copper production would increase by half in 4 years, zinc production would double, steel would jump from 33 to 45 million tons, coal production would increase by 172 million tons. America's industrial capacity would increase fivefold in the years after 1914. Shipbuilding would reach 3 million tons compared to 200,000 in 1914. Industrial profits would soar between 20 to 50%. American exports would grow in 4 years of war as much as in the preceding 125 years of American history. Wheat and flour exports would double, meat and steel exports would quadruple. The economics of the war would make America-based banks the recipients of half the world's gold. As a whole, banking in the Americas benefited from the European upheaval. Massive markets in South America, which until this point had been controlled by British capitalists, opened to American business. American investment in Latin America increased 13 times in these few short years, and American companies came to control more than two-thirds of all fruit, rubber, sugar, oil, nitrate, and copper exports. American businesses would gain 47% of Brazil's international trade and 50% of Venezuela's during the war years, and would export twice as much as the British companies. American-based banks moved into Latin America. Morgan Guarantee Trust in Argentina, Mercantile in Venezuela and Peru, National City in Brazil and Uruguay were only the most important. Yet, although the war had created opportunities for the banks, the great majority of Americans still regarded it as an incomprehensible conflict in which the United States should avoid any involvement. From the outset, the Allies had bombarded America with anti-German atrocity stories. Their impact was limited, because aside from the neutralist sentiments of the people, the American news media, much of which was controlled by influential Jews, was pro-German for its own reasons. Jewish money and manpower had been heavily invested in the Bolshevik Revolution, and regarded Germany as a vital component in their bid to overthrow the Russian government and install a communist regime. It was not until 1917 that Germany outlived its usefulness. By then, the Tsar had been overthrown and the Kaiser had proved himself useless in convincing his Turkish allies to relinquish their Palestinian province as a home for the Jews. Although the Turks were unwilling to let go of Palestine, particularly at a time when the fortunes of war were weighing in their favor, the British establishment was more than eager to promise Palestine to the Jews of the world in exchange for a favor. Lord Balfour transacted the bargain, as a consideration for Jewish assistance in bringing America into the war on the British side. The government of Great Britain would deliver Palestine into Jewish hands once the war had been won. This British promissory note became known as the Balfour Declaration. Jewish assistance was indeed invaluable in reversing almost overnight America's entrenched neutralism. Suddenly, Allied propaganda received full coverage in American newspapers. From 1917, the public was fed fantastic stories dressed up as news, such as the discovery that the Germans had secret gun emplacements in the United States ready to bombard New York and Washington. This alarming news had been planted by the Allies as early as October 1914 and had succeeded in finding its way into presidential intelligence reports. "We have good reason," said an alarmed Wilson to House, "to believe that the Germans have built in our own country concrete platforms for guns as powerful as the ones they are using in Belgium and France. As far as I am concerned, I do not say aloud what I know of this report. If it got out, the whole country would be stirred to such an extent that I fear the consequences." Despite his credulity, at the time Wilson wanted peace, but it was remarkable that he could believe such obviously absurd information, to the point of ordering an army general to conduct an inquiry with the utmost discretion. There was also the revelation, that the German military attaché in Washington was going to blow up New York's port and subway. An official inquiry disproved the rumor. House understood the power of rumor mills and manipulated news. In the early days he tried to calm Wilson down, "General Wood's inquiry will demonstrate the inanity of these rumors. Most misunderstandings are caused by lying reports or come from sours of discord." Thus, in the early years of the war, all Allied efforts to bring the United States into the war failed. The British ambassador in Washington regretfully reported, "At least 85% of the Americans want neutrality." Wilson knew that. He also knew it would be political suicide to oppose neutrality in his 1916 bid for a second term. Neutrality was Wilson's campaign theme. He called for strict neutrality, a real spirit of neutrality, a spirit of impartiality and goodwill towards all interested parties at every opportunity. During the election campaign, Wilson, indeed, placed the Germans on the same footing as the British. Wilson's relationship with Germany was nevertheless an ambivalent one. He knew almost nothing of German history and culture and had a deep hatred of German philosophers, or rather his conception of them. Somewhat in line with Clemenceau's railing against the Munich beer halls as temples of German thought, Wilson explained as early as August 1914 his aversion. "German philosophy is essentially an egotistic concept, devoid of any spirituality." Where had Wilson gotten such an interpretation, so devoid of knowledge and rationality? As a Calvinist, he regarded Kant, Hegel, and Schopenhauer as threats to his religious convictions and his concept of politics. In his mind, the German philosophers, not the Kaiser, were responsible for the war. Wilson's irrational hatred was shared by most of his cabinet, which included a strong contingent of pro-British sympathizers as well. The Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, whose son-in-law was serving as a British officer, was told by his cabinet colleague, Lane, on May 5, 1915, "I believe not a single cabinet member has a drop of Teuton blood in his veins. Two among us were born British, two of my cousins and three of Mrs. Lane's cousins are now fighting in the British Army." House felt it necessary to caution the members, "We must be very careful in the way we act because, as you know, the Americans are very emotional." House 1,351. House's reference to American emotionality epitomized the attitude of the Washington pro-British elite towards the people they ruled. The Americans, like a potentially hostile mass, had to be treated cautiously, and manipulated into accepting what was deemed best for them by their British betters. Ambassador Page, who represented the United States in London, found it hard to hide his pro-British fervor, and became a relentless propagandist for the British establishment. House, forgetting how condescendingly he'd been treated in London, or possibly because of it, became an eager errand boy for the lofty British lords. Exercising the caution he had urged on the members of cabinet, he devised a secret code to communicate with the British ambassador in Washington. Starting out by being the ambassador's confidant, he became his accomplice. For the first 2 years of the war, Washington was the scene of amazing double dealing. Officially, the government loudly proclaimed its neutrality, with Wilson declaring, "This is a war which does not affect us in any way. Its causes are totally alien to us." House 1,342. While the American people were lapping up these fine speeches which reflected their own views, their elected representatives were sabotaging the very neutrality they had been entrusted to preserve. Wilson's aversion to Germans was somewhat mitigated by his political aspirations. He planned to launch another peace offensive. After the German victories of August 1914, Wilson wrote to Zimmermann on September 5, 1914, "Now that the Kaiser has just demonstrated so well the strength of his armies, wouldn't he find that if he accepted peace negotiations today, he would make a gesture which would confirm the peaceful intentions he has always been proud of?" The German ambassador in Washington immediately informed House, "If the Entente is sending a signal, Germany will show itself reasonable." House 1,383. After conversing with the ambassador, House recorded in his diary on December 27, 1914, "If I could obtain from the Allies their consent to start negotiations, I would find the Germans very well disposed. The British Foreign Minister, Sir Edward Grey, was less forthcoming. "All we can promise here, if Germany sincerely and seriously seeks peace, is that I will agree to consult our friends on conditions they will deem acceptable." House had been received by Grey in London, but he was given a lecture on English blackbirds as compared to the Texan variety. Grey had refused to discuss any peace proposals except to ask House, "The President must not talk about peace conditions." House was told in London that the British government would send 1.5 million more troops to the war zone and, like Wellington at Waterloo, catch the fox by the tail. The French government was also disinclined to talk of peace. House noted, "They not only want Alsace-Lorraine but much more. Thus one cannot even envisage peace." House, 1,447. French bureaucrats and politicians alike were blunt with House. They did not want to hear anything about peace. House was perceptive enough to establish the wide difference between the rulers of France and the great mass of Frenchmen. "In France," he wrote President Wilson, "the ruling classes do not want peace, but the majority of the people and the men in the trenches all want peace very much." Back in Britain, House had come to similar conclusion. "The war has not rallied the approval of the English people, and if public opinion were to be heard, one would see how really unpopular the war was. The horrors of war, instead of sobering governments, would inflame them even more." Greed was overpowering. The allies Britain had recruited from the far corners of the earth regarded peace as a blight on their spoils of war. "South Africa," noted House, "has no intention of giving up German Africa, which it has seized. Australia likewise will not give up German Oceania." Since the Allied spring offensive of 1915 had failed miserably, the Allies decided to starve the Germans into submission by a blockade. The employment and conduct of blockades was strictly regulated by international law. The British had been the prime advocates for the protection of neutral vessels throughout the seas. The first Hague Conference had enshrined the inviolability of private property during naval warfare, and the second had, at Sir Edward Grey's urging, consented to renounce all principles defining contraband during warfare. At the 1907 Hague Conference, the British declared, "In order to decrease the difficulties of neutral trading countries in time of war, His Majesty's government is ready to forego the principle of wartime contraband with nations willing to sign a convention to this effect. The right of inspection will be maintained only for the purpose of verifying the merchant ship's neutrality." House, 1,456. The British State Secretary Root supported these same principles, i.e. the guaranteed immunity of the belligerents' private property on the seas. Only the contraband of arms and munitions would be prohibited. Transport of goods and raw material would be free of all controls and free of any hindrance. These declarations represented British interests then. In 1907, the British establishment's lifeline and power depended on the importation of goods and raw material from the rest of the world. When their own treaties and declarations no longer suited them, however, the British government deliberately violated the 1907 Hague Treaty, as well as all the other international treaties it had signed. It was like changing the rules of cricket in the middle of the game. When war broke out, the British ignored the provisions of the treaties they signed. They intercepted neutral vessels, including American vessels, and imposed a forced sale of their contents. On September 6, 1914, House informed Wilson, "Britain is preventing access to neutral ports. First it inspects the ship's contents, and if there is foodstuff, a forced sale is imposed." House, 1,366. The outrage was so flagrant that even the pro-British cabinet member Lane was prompted to write on May 5, 1915 to House. "The British are not behaving well. They are detaining our vessels, they have created a new international code. We have shown much indulgence and tolerance for the way they have taken the seas as their private toll gates." House, 1,512. House declared the British practice illegal and stated on June 2, 1915, "The British people would never have tolerated such practices if they had been in our position." House, 1,520. The American voters were getting irate. How dare the British stop American exports? House felt the danger and on June 3, 1915 warned Wilson, the British put everybody in the same bag regardless of nationality. On March 9, 1915 the publisher of the San Francisco Daily Chronicle was the first to demand retribution against British lawbreaking. Britain was wrong in declaring a blockade against Germany. If Britain further persists, our government will be totally justified in putting an embargo on war material. Lloyd George panicked at that prospect, writing House on June 2, 1915, the cause of the Allies would be seriously threatened if the Americans stopped supplying their armies at this time. House, 1, 518. House tried to convince the British to return to a less vexing conception of international law. Without consulting their partners at The Hague, they had disregarded their own signatures on the treaties and embarked on a piratical policy against the nations of the entire world. Wilson wanted some kind of gentleman's agreement to end this flagrant violation of international law. He proposed that the nomenclature of contraband goods be limited to war material only and all the rest have total commercial freedom. Merchant vessels, whether neutral or belligerent, must travel freely outside territorial waters as long as they do not carry contraband thus defined. Wilson's proposal to the British was almost identical to the instructions Sir Edward Grey had given his delegates at the 1907 Hague Conference. House pointed out it should not be difficult for the British to honor their treaty obligations since they had the most to benefit, the threat of submarine warfare would be removed. According to the principle of freedom of the seas, the country with the most overseas colonies would benefit the most. Britain would get the lion's share of the agreement. House, 1, 458. For the British establishment, however, the lion's share was far from enough, it wanted all and everything. Since Philip II of Spain and Napoleon of France had confronted the British monopoly of the seas without success, it was unlikely that House and Wilson would have much impact on the rulers of the city, London's financial nerve center. The Germans welcomed Wilson's proposals. German diplomat Dernburg informed Washington, "If Britain accepts freedom of the seas, the Germans will immediately evacuate Belgium." House, 1, 461. Wilson's good intentions were, however, thwarted within his own cabinet by the pro-British lobby. The president instructed his ambassador in London to present his views with the utmost vigor. To this presidential order, Ambassador Page replied that he had no desire to present any such views to the British government. German compromise and American peace moves did not interest the British government, the chief objective of which at that time was to draw the United States into the war. The British wanted to tap America's dollars and America's young men for their war. Grey rejected Wilson's offer with polite cynicism. "The United States' entry into the war is of great benefit to Great Britain, while acceding to your demand would mean that we would be acting as a neutral." House, 1, 468. Wilson's efforts were given wide publicity to impress American voters, who were getting more and more outraged with British violations. But behind the scenes the British lobby was inexorably dragging America into the war. House felt confident in writing, "The president sympathizes from the bottom of his heart with the cause and aims of the Allies." House, 1, 520. House was then playing a double game, vocal protestations of neutrality for the sake of the electorate, while scheming with the British to destroy America's neutrality. On June 1, 1915 House was able, before leaving London, to inform the British cabinet confidentially, "It is my firm intention to insist that the president does not wage a token war. We must join it with all the strength, the virility and tenacity of our people in such a way that Europe will remember our intervention for at least a century." The date was significant, June 1, 1915. American participation had already been decided on and it would not be a token war. House, somewhat carried away by his war fervor, cabled Wilson, "Our intervention will decrease rather than increase human losses. The American young men who would die on the Argonne front in 1918 would sadly contradict House's absurd statement."